Buddhist Summer School, talk given Sunday morning, 28th August 1977. Let us begin today with one of the very important statements which the Buddha made. It comes in the Alagaddu Pama Sutta. Formerly, I, O monks, as well as now, lay down simply dukkha and the stopping or deliverance from dukkha. The Pali goes, Pubbe chaham bhikkhave etarahi cha dukkhaṃ cha panyāpemi dukkhassa cha nirodham. There is another statement which comes in the Mahāvagga, one of the volumes of the Vinaya text. Come monk, well taught is Dhamma, fare the Brahma faring for making an utter end of ill. Ehi bhikkhu svakkhato dhammo chara brahmacharyam sammadukkhassa antakiriyaya. Let us combine these two statements and relate them to the whole of the Buddha Dhamma. To do so, let us consider that remarkable autobiographical discourse, the Ariya Pariyesana Sutta, in some detail. The Buddha talks of the two quests. One is the un-Aryan quest, the other is the Aryan quest. And what is the un-Aryan quest? Un-Aryan simply means the unworthy, and Aryan simply means the worthy. The un-Aryan quest is the worldly quest. And he explains, because of selfness, being liable to birth, aging, decay, dying, death, one's sorrow and stain, defilement, one seeks likewise what is liable to all these, namely a family, servants, possessions, worldly success, and so on. Note carefully, because of selfness, one is liable to all these things: birth, aging, decay, death, sorrow, and stain, because of selfness. And because of selfness, one seeks all that which is liable to birth, aging, death, etc. That is the un-Aryan quest. Next, he talks of the Aryan quest. A person similarly liable, before he starts upon this quest, liable to birth, death, and so on, because of selfness, he emphasizes that. But he, having seen, having a glimpse, or having known the peril, the misery of the conditioned state of decay, aging, death, sorrow, stain, defilements, and so forth, one seeks the not conditioned state, the not aging, the not decaying, the not dying state, that which is beyond sorrow, that which is beyond stain. Now it is perfectly obvious from what he says that this does not refer essentially to the body, because everyone knows that the body will necessarily die. In fact, the whole psychophysical organism will completely disintegrate. Therefore, it must refer to the realization of a deathless state, a sorrowless state, here and now, in mind and consciousness. It has no reference to the perishable psychophysical organism. But it has reference to the manner in which we are conscious of existence. And because the manner in which our consciousness of existence and undergo a complete transformation, therefore, our actual life in our existential condition here, our psychophysical condition, is completely altered. It is completely transformed into the mode of life which is truly the good. That is the important point to bear in mind. He goes on to speak of himself, and he says how, whilst he was still the Bodhisattva, the one who had seen the vision in the distance and had undertaken within himself the task of transcending this ill condition, seeing that because of selfness he was liable to all this ill, he sought the state which was the unconditioned, the unaging, undecaying, undying, etc., which meant the uttermost security from bondage, which meant nirvana. So he decided to leave home and go away into homelessness. Remember, he was the son of a princeling, a small kingdom, perhaps only a chieftaincy, but he's usually called King Suddhodana, his father was. And in this discourse, the Buddha says that his parents wept in the Lalita Vistara. Sir Edwin Arnold's translation is called The Light of Asia. You find that legendary account where He wakes up in the night, sees his wife and child sleeping, and sees all the pleasures of the palace and the means for the pleasures of the palace lying about in all sorts of postures and tired, and he feels a revulsion from it all. And he summons his groom, who brings his horse Kantaka, who takes him out into the forest. That is the legendary account. But in his own words, he says his parents wept and wailed. But despite that, cutting off his hair, donning yellow robes, he went out of home into homelessness as a quester, a searcher for whatever is good, for whatever is the good, searching for the incomparable, matchless path to peace. The legendary account, you may remember, says that one fine day he went out and saw the signs of man's misery, which he himself had never known, apparently, according to the legend. But that's obviously absurd. From birth onwards, we all scream with a bellyache, particularly. We know what pain is. We know what it is to experience the impatience or annoyance of mother or father or something, get smacked and so forth. So he must have known all that. He must have seen around him all the time death and decay and sorrow and so on. So we can more or less discount the legendary account. It's very pleasant to read. Makes a nice story, but this is the more accurate statement of fact. So, in the forest, he meets with his first teacher, Alara the Kalama, as he's called, belonged to the Kalama clan, that's all it means. Like we say, one of the Campbells or one of the McDonalds or something like that, you see. He met Alara Kalama and he went to him and said, I wish to follow this Dhamma, that is, the one which Alara Kalama taught. And to Alara he says, I want to fare the Brahma faring in this Dhamma and discipline. Now how does he fare? He goes through the discipline which he is taught, and in due time he finds himself mastering all that he was taught. But that which he was taught was something which he knew only in terms of words, not in terms of realization. It is important to see what he actually says. Here we are. When he is giving this autobiographical discourse to his own monks, he says, I, monks, as far as mere lip service, mere repetition of the doctrines was concerned, spoke the doctrine of knowledge and the doctrine of the elders, and I claimed that I know, I see. As far as mere lip service was concerned, the mere repetition of the words of the doctrine. Then it occurred to me, monks, but Alara the Kalama does not merely proclaim this Dhamma simply out of faith. He uses the word faith here, but we may put it more accurately and say out of mere belief, that he just believed these ideas. Alara does not merely claim this Dhamma out of faith. Having realized super knowledge, entering on it, I am abiding therein. Then Gotama approaches Alara and asks him, to what extent do you, having realized super knowledge for yourself, realized it, entering thereon, proclaim the Dhamma? What he was inquiring was, what mode of consciousness are you able to enter upon and abide in it? Then Alara the Kalama answered, the plane of nothing, akinchinyanata ayatana. Then it occurred to me, monks, it is not Alara alone who has faith. I too have faith. Not Alara alone who has mindfulness. I too have mindfulness, concentration, and intuitive wisdom. Suppose now I should strive for the realization of the Dhamma, not be satisfied merely with knowing the teachings as a system of concepts expressed in so many words. And having practiced, Gotama realizes this plane of nothing, of nothing, it is usually said, but nothing is a much better term. The plane of nothing, as it is called, or nothing, is one of the samapattis, as they are called. You know how these deep states of consciousness are named the four jhanas and then the four samapattis. A jhana, of course, is the Pali for dhyana, states of attentiveness, of inward awareness. Jhana is the Pali correspondent of dhyana. Then there are the samapattis spoken of, which the dictionary says, the Pali dictionary says, are attainments. But there is another meaning to this word samapatti, which is more important really than attainment. And this is coalescence. The samapattis are coalescences. What is experienced by and in the individual has its corresponding counterparts in terms of the universal. So there are archetypal correspondences to the individual realization. And the plane of nothing simply represents this archetypal correspondence. So, having practiced, he realized this state. But Gautama is dissatisfied with this state. He experiences a certain state of consciousness, but he says to himself, it does not conduce to disregard, nor to dispassion, nor to stopping, nor to tranquility, nor to super knowledge, nor to awakening, nor to nibbana. Now, there are other words which we can use. This state of consciousness does not conduce to disenchantment with the world. Nibbida is the word in the original Pali, is disenchantment, virago, desirelessness. This translation says dispassion, but it is desirelessness. Instead of disregard, use the word disenchantment. It's much more instructive. Disenchantment with the world. Nor does it conduce to desirelessness, nor to stopping, but the stopping of what? Of the limitations of the skandhas, the five constituents of our being, body, feelings, thoughts, the mental patterns, the sankharas and the volitions, and discriminative consciousness, vijnana. Doesn't conduce to the stopping of the limitations imposed upon inward awareness of reality by the skandhas. Because those cannot be removed, therefore, disenchantment with worldliness cannot be brought about. A person who can enter the deep states of consciousness is still quite liable to worldliness. It's a very important point. It has its counterpart in the life of the worldly person who is cultured, who is developed, very brilliant. His intellect can penetrate into the deep things, but his personal life need not at all, therefore, be the living representative of the truly good, the truly purified, perfected. Therefore, the worldly person, or the person who is subject to worldliness, is not yet the living vehicle of transcendence. And this is one of the very important things to bear in mind when we think of and strive for entering the deep states of consciousness. This is why all these people in the world today who take drugs and this and that in order to go for a trip, and then they come back and say, oh, I experienced this, that and the other wonderful thing, and they wear fantastic robes and set up their own spirit shop and sell their goods at a fantastic price. They are the deceivers, the rogues. as is said in the New Testament, beware of the antichrists, wolves in sheep's clothing. So you see, you have it straight from the mouth of the enlightened, the Holy One, the truly Holy One, that all this does not conduce, entering the deep states, going for trips and so forth, does not conduce to the realization of nirvana, to the realization of the real fulfillment of man, the fulfillment of the purpose of his existence. It does not conduce to calm, upasama, abhinya. Abhinya is a word which has many meanings. Straightforward meaning is profound knowledge, very deep knowledge. Jnana is knowledge in the sense of wisdom. Jnana is wisdom, you see. And abhi means profound. It's an intensifier. Profound knowledge. Now, what is this profound knowledge? It is explained in the commentaries. It refers to clairvoyance and clairaudience, to the development, the release of certain psychic powers which are spoken of in terms like levitation, being able to make oneself as light as possible or as heavy as desired, to be able to plunge into the earth and come out of the water and walk on the waters and all that sort of thing. These are ways of talking which unfortunately mislead most people. Just leave them aside. They are of little importance. You know those lovely stories where the disciple comes in great glee to the master and says that after 14 years of striving, now I can walk across the river to the other shore, to the other bank of the river. And the master says, 14 years of striving? My dear fellow, the ferry would take you for a penny across. So you see, don't worry too much about this. But the clairvoyance and clairaudience are realities. Simple realities. Simple but profound and important. They are sensitivities, highly developed sensitivities. You know how often the Buddha says, by my mind, I knew the mind of the other person. I know what is in the mind of the other person, how he is feeling, how he is thinking. And it's an interesting thing that in the New Testament, you find the same said of Jesus, but you won't find it easily out of the authorized and revised versions. In the modern English translation, which is a much more prosaic but very straightforward translation, it is said, but Jesus knew what was in the mind of the other. Simple clairvoyance. When the woman was brought to him and he said, you have had five husbands and so forth, you can give an allegorical interpretation, but you can also see signs of clairvoyance. there. So Gautama leaves Alarada Kalama and seeks another teacher. This time it is Uddaka, Ramaputta, the son of Rama. Ramaputta means. And the same process takes place. And when Gautama asks Ramaputta, what is the extent to which you have realized this Dhamma and can live it? And Ramaputta says, to the plane of neither perception nor non-perception. And the same thing happens. Gautama realizes that plane, but he finds that it is not conducive to disenchantment with the world, to stopping, to Nibbana. Therefore, he leaves Ramaputta and then he goes to the river Niranjara, by the banks of the river Niranjara. Now we must note the cause of his dissatisfaction. Mere verbal and conceptual knowledge is not enough. One just talks about it. And we all know from our own experience in various societies and summer schools and autumn schools and weekend programs and so on, what a lot of talk goes on. One can listen to a group of hens or geese and you will also find much goose talk going on. Gautama is not satisfied with this at all. He is seeking the good, the incomparable, matchless path to that peace, that supreme silence, which is the creative power in action in itself. That is what he seeks. The state of Nibbana. Nirvana. And the meaning of Nirvana, the first meaning, is that which is completely burnt out, extinguished by burning out. But what is burnt out of you or me, the person here? It's ill. And what is that state of ill? This enchantment with the world, this state of bondage, this state of ignorance, not ignorance merely in the sense of not knowing, but the ignorance which means the state in which one is not in continual and complete communion with the totality. And therefore, oneself, oneselfness obtrudes itself upon the world process. So this plane of neither perception nor non-perception, neva sanya na sanya yatana, neva sanyana, neither perception. Jnanas, nas, nasanya, nat. Nasanya, sanyayatana. It's a mouthful to speak. Which is this plane of neither perception nor non-perception is the summit of becoming, the becoming process. The whole of the becoming process, remember, is still liable to death, to mortality. It is not the Nirodha, the complete release from the asava, which is called the bhava-asava. Now the word asava is usually translated as canker. But I think that if we look at its first meaning, an overflow, an exudation. When, for instance, you wound a tree and there is an exudation out of it which flows out, you see, an overflow or an outflow. Take its first meaning. The asava is an exudation, an overflow. Now, an overflow of what? Imagine yourself in the state of supreme communion. You are in complete relationship with the ultimate creative power of the universe. Now, when that consciousness, that awareness, gets caught up by some sense desire or pleasure or something like that, by some ambition to become this, that or the other, or the desire to achieve or attain this, that or the other, which belongs to the state of mortality, finitude, therefore the ill state, the suffering state, your consciousness has overflowed, flowed out. There's an exudation. So there's your asava. That's the actuality of what happens to you. So you see, to take the first meaning of asava in this context is more helpful to us than to regard it as a canker. We think of a canker as something external which is eating us away or something. No, it's just your own awareness spilling back into worldliness. From transcendence you spill back into worldliness. And the main forms are kama-asava, you see, bhava-asava. Kama is pleasure, the lust for sensational delights. Bhava-asava, the ambition to become this, become the other, and so forth, you see, which are all limited things which only bring suffering in the long run. Dithyasava, that is to say, the indulgence in speculations. You remember, at least some of you will remember how often I have said, when you get questions rising up in the mind, write them down and look at them. What exactly are you seeking in asking the question? Another view, another idea. Now you see, all these views, all these explanations to what I'm saying to you, things like what I'm saying to you now, they all get caught up in this dithi-asava. You see? So the overflow, the asava of views. That is why the holy ones teach, beware of acquiring knowledge. It has little or no relationship to true wisdom. We have to start with knowledge in the ordinary worldly sense because there is no option to that. Being constituted as we are, we have to start where we are. Just as in becoming a quester for the good, for nirvana, one starts where one is with the not supreme good, that which is not nirvana. One starts where one is. So knowledge is something which one starts with, but one gets enamored of knowledge. The acquisition of facts and explanations. But the more we grow, we realize that we do not see facts as facts, although we say this, that and the other is the fact, but it is not. And the explanation which is given is something which is not the explanation. When we have transcended all these limitations, you will find that fact and explanation are an identity. You are that fact, which is a completely different thing from seeing the fact externally, either with the senses or with the brain, in terms of the knowledge of the fact. What you are seeing is just your mental construct, which is always a distorted picture of reality. That is why the Buddha teaches, put them all aside. You will naturally say, well, why do we come to the summer schools? Why do we go here? Why do we go there seeking for wisdom, seeking for knowledge? Yes, exactly. Why? I've asked you over and over again, why do you turn to religion? Liable to selfness, one seeks for the self. And yet we can't avoid it. This is the strange part of life. This is what produces the tribulation attached to the living of the holy life. Terrific tribulation. But it is through the stimulus of that very tribulation that your inner resources are called out till finally you will be alone. You will be silent. Are you practicing your silence day in, day out here this week? So the Buddha goes to Uruvela, the camp township by the banks of the Niranjara. Now here at last there comes the realization. And note how he puts it. It's translated in so many ways. Miss Horner translates it by the word one, W-O-N, one. He won the birthless or the not conditioned state. He won the unborn, the unaging, the undying, etc. But you see the difficulty of the words. How can you seek the unborn? To seek means to look for something. in order to obtain what you are seeking, you have to know what you are seeking. Supposing you lose your pen or a book or your hat or something, you know what you are looking for. So when you find it, you will recognize it. You will recognize it, as we say. But the unborn, you don't know. What is this transcendent unborn? You just don't know. Haven't a clue. How can you seek for it? When you study the texts, study very, very critically. You can't seek the unborn. But that is the only way people have been able to express it. Instead of saying, then it is also translated by others as Gautama came into the unborn, the undecaying, undying, etc. I like to put it in this form. Gautama emerged, got merged into the unborn. To say I won the unborn implies previous knowledge of the unborn. But if you suddenly get immersed in it, You don't know, you're walking along, we'll say, and you don't know that there is a pond here, and it is perhaps a little bit dark, and you just fall into it, don't you? Something like that happens. The better way of putting it, the best way that I can think of putting it, is that when you yourself are completely still and quiet within, utterly void of all the processes of thought and feeling which go on, then this transcendence suddenly takes you up into itself. You find in the New Testament, for instance, the phrase, and the manhood was taken up into the Godhead. Was taken up into the Godhead. You find in the Upanishadic teachings that the individual being, the Jivatma, is completely at one with Brahma, the Absolute All. But that oneness doesn't imply that the individual remains as an identifiable entity in that Brahman consciousness. This is the point to bear in mind. There is the complete egolessness. The Pali word which is used for this state is ajjagamang. Ajjagamang. Got merged into it. Gamang is the going, and ajja is the supreme. The ajjaga is the third person singular preterite of adhi gacchati. Gacchati, a going towards, and Adi, the supreme, the ultimate, the goal, the end. Ajjagamang. You see? And in that state, Gautama realized the ajatam, the not conditioned, the unborn, the not being born. Ajarang, the undecaying, abhyadim, the unaging. Amatang, the undying. Asokam, the unsorrowing. The asankilitang, the undefiled state. Now you see, in this complete and perfect realization, through the utter purification of all the defilements, through the utter transcending of all selfness, not only does Gautama enter into the deepest states of consciousness possible, including all that Alara and Uddaka had taught him, and remember that he doesn't discard all that at all, because in his own teaching all those states of jhana and samapatti are mentioned. But he touches this state which is called the cessation, the complete stopping of perception and feeling, using the words perception and feeling in their transcendental sense. That is to say, the perception and feeling which is not associated only with the sense functions and the discursive thought process of the brain, but the perception and feeling which is without words, without concepts, and which has completely coalesced the samapattis, completely coalesced with the transcendental mode of perception and feeling, which are not modes of perception and feeling, but those are the only two words which we can use, because we in ourselves, in our limited sense, have these words which we understand. And those samapattis, those archetypal modes, are the correspondence of these two. That is why it is called the stopping of perception and feeling. I don't know whether any of the commentaries or anybody ever puts that properly. But that's what it is. The theistic religions present this sort of thing, these archetypal correspondence of our modes of perception and feelings by personifying those transcendental modes as archangels and angels. Then the angel of the Lord spoke unto so and so. You see, or the Spirit of God moved him, or something like that. You find this mode of teaching in all the great religions. You'll find it in Zarathustrianism. You'll find it in several of the Upanishads too. A question is asked by the disciple, and the one who answers is the first, second, or third person of the Holy Trinity, the Hindu Trinity, Brahma, Vishnu, or Shiva, or you find some of the other great names mentioned. You see, and so on. It is in the Old Testament, in Jewish religion, it is everywhere. You find the same. So now, two things happen simultaneously in this ultimate realization by Gautama. One is the reaching into the state of the cessation, the ending of perception and feeling. And the other thing which happens is this supreme wisdom, which is of such a nature that there is no more overflowing of Gautama's mode of awareness of reality, of truth, into the forms of pleasure or becoming or speculative views or the state of ignorance, avidya, avidya. Those two have to be there together in order that the actual, complete, ultimate liberation may be there. So, Gautama ends up by saying, knowledge and vision arose in me. Unshakable is freedom for me. This is the last jati, the last conditioned state. There is not now again becoming. Gautama now is Samma Sambuddha, supremely enlightened one, Tathagata, thus gone.